face down, bumping lightly against the muddy bed below the flowing water. The body was probably carried for several miles, frowning with gentle surprise, arms held a little away from his sides, legs stiff. The underwater plants ran their fronds along the feathered headdress the boy was wearing, across the boy's forehead and war paint stripes and lips, down across the fringed buckskin shirt and wolf-tooth necklace, across loincloth and deerskin leggings, tracing the feet in their moccasins. The fish and other scavengers were mostly asleep during this period. The body bumped against rocks and branches, scraped along gravel, but it was mostly preserved. In April, when the two freshman college girls saw the boy's face under the thin layer of ice among the reeds and cattails at the edge of the old skating pond, they at first imagined the corpse was a discarded mannequin or a plastic Halloween mask. They were collecting pond water specimens for their biology course, and both of them were feeling scientific rather than superstitious, and one of the girls reached down and touched the face's cheek with the eraser tip of her pencil. During that same period of months, November through April, Dustin Tillman had been drifting along his own trajectory. He was 41 years old, married with two teenage sons, a psychologist with a small practice, and formerly, he sometimes told people, some occasional forays into forensics. His life, he thought, was a collection of the usual stuff: driving to and from work, listening to the radio, checking and answering his steadily accumulating email, shopping at the supermarket, watching select highly regarded shows on television, and reading a few books that had been well reviewed, helping the boys with their homework, details that were, he was increasingly aware, units of measurement by which he was parceling out his life. When his cousin Kate called him later that week after the body was found, he was already feeling a lot of vague anxiety. He was having a hard time about his upcoming birthday, which he realized seemed like a very bourgeois and mundane thing to worry about. He had recently quit smoking, so there was that too. Without nicotine, his brain seemed murky with circling, unfocused dread, and the world itself appeared somehow more unfriendly, emanating, he couldn't help but think, a soft glow of ill will. Chapter 2. A few days after the body was discovered, Dustin picked up the phone, and it was his cousin Kate from Los Angeles. "Listen," she said, "I have some very weird news." Dustin said, "Kate?" They spoke regularly enough, once every few months or so, but it was usually on birthdays or holidays. "It's about Russell," she said. "Russell? My brother Russell?" He was sitting at the desk in his office, his study, as he liked to call it, on the third floor of the house, and he stopped typing on the computer and glanced over at his ashtray, which was now full of little sugar-free hard candies, lozenges wrapped in cellophane. "Don't tell me," Dustin said. "He's escaped." "Just listen," Kate said. Dustin hadn't spoken to Russell, his adopted older brother, since Russell had been sent to prison. He hadn't written to him or even kept tabs on him, really, and the thoughts that he had of him were of the most cursory sort. For example, he'd see a movie or TV show that took place in a prison, and he'd think, "I wonder what Russell is doing right now." He had a general idea of what prison might be like. This included things like homosexual rape and shanks carved out of toothbrushes or spoons. Sometimes he would picture men in the prison library studying legal books, or in cafeterias eating terrible casseroles, or lying moodily, fully dressed on metal bunk beds, glaring at the ceiling. Various images of this sort had come to Dustin over the years. But mostly he'd imagined Russell as he'd been when they were growing up together. Russell, 6 years his elder, who shot him once with a BB gun in the back while he was running away. Russell, listening to death metal music and carving a pentagram into his forearm with the sharp end of a drafting compass. Russell, who had used improvised kung fu moves to destroy a magnificent snowman that Dustin had built. Russell, who was delighted by Dustin's fear of the dark and would wait until Dustin was comfortably alone in a room and then sneak by and turn off the light and pull the door closed, and Dustin, trapped in darkness, would let out a scream. Chapter 3. On On the night that their parents were going to be murdered, Dustin Tillman and his cousins Kate and Wave were sitting at the kitchen table in the camper, which was parked for the moment in the driveway of Dustin's family's house in western Nebraska. It was the beginning of June 1983. Their two families were planning to leave the next morning to go on vacation together. They would travel through Wyoming and up to Yellowstone, and they would stay at various campgrounds along the way. But that night, the camper was like their own little private apartment that they were living in. The three of them were playing cards. A transistor radio emitted songs from a distant Denver rock and roll station. A heavy, beetle-bodied June bug beat its wings and ticked thickly against the light fixture on the ceiling. The girls were only 17, but they were splitting a light beer, which they had taken from the refrigerator in the camper. They had poured it half and half into two glass tumblers. The night was warm, and the girls were wearing their bikini tops and cut-off shorts. They had used a curling iron to make flips in their shoulder-length blonde hair, but the flips had grown a little limp. They were twins, not identical, but almost. Dustin was 13, and he sat there, his cards fanned out, and the girls said, "Dustin, it's your turn." And Kate reached down and, without thinking, scratched a bug bite on her bare ankle, and Dustin was looking at it surreptitiously, the way her fingernail made a white mark on the reddish-tan skin, the fingernail which had some polish on it that was flaking off. Chapter 4. In retrospect, Dustin couldn't remember much that was significant about that particular morning when they discovered the body. The day was clear and cold and sunny, and he woke up and felt fairly happy. Happy in that bland, daily way that doesn't even recognize itself as happiness, waking into a day that shouldn't expect anything more than a series of rote actions, showering and pouring coffee into a cup and dressing and turning a key in an ignition and driving down streets that are so familiar that you don't even recall making certain turns or stops. You were not even present, were you? In retrospect, another day, late in the morning, early in the century, along another long Midwestern interstate corridor in Ohio. This particular road connected a whole series of fertile little towns to the cities, though lately what was once farmland was being developed and rows of identical houses rose out of the muddy fields instead of crops. The backyards of these new communities were punctuated with above-ground pools and swing sets, and many featured little man-made ponds, which at this moment in spring looked like parking lots made of water instead of asphalt. Once they were landscaped, maybe they would look a little more appealing. There was a lot of roadkill these days as well. The highways now cut the countryside into narrow parcels, and the displaced woodland animals were often caught moving from one section to the next. Raccoons, possums, deer, foxes, their bodies tossed onto the berm in the position of restless sleepers, mouths open, eyes closed, almost peaceful looking. People, too, seemed to meet their end more frequently on the roads, and Dustin had noticed the way that mourners seemed more and more to erect small roadside shrines to those who perished in accidents, crosses fashioned out of picket wood, often surrounded by piles of brightly colored objects, usually plastic flowers, but sometimes green Christmas wreaths or plastic holly or ribbons. Very frequently clusters of stuffed animals, bunnies and teddy bears and duckies, sometimes items of clothing, such as shirts or baseball caps, which gave the crosses a certain scarecrow-like quality. Coming up to the exit, he saw the flashing of the police cars gathered together, their blue and red lights dappling in the mild spring rain. Some orange road cones had been set out, and a policeman in a reflector-striped raincoat stood there waving the cars past with a plastic Dayglo baton. Dustin slowed and turned down the radio and steered into the detour around the roadblock that the policeman indicated with an elegant sweep of his wand. There was a clutch of cops gathered at the edge of the bridge, grim and damp from drizzle, and drinking coffee out of styrofoam cups, and Dustin observed them with interest. He enjoyed watching police procedural dramas on television, and he had loved it back in the day when he would sometimes be called to testify as a court-approved expert. Remembering this gave him a wistful twinge. He guessed that whatever was going on must be fairly serious. Chapter 5. There was a famous photo of Dustin and Kate and Wave. The picture that had been in the newspapers which had been nominated for the Pulitzer. It didn't win, but it was recognizable, a remarkable and memorable crime photo. Here were the children, the beautiful blonde twins, and the skinny freckled boy between them, and the police are leading them, hurrying them from the house. In the photo, Wave is weeping openly, her mouth contorted, screaming maybe, and Kate is looking off to the side fearfully as if someone is going to attack her, and Dustin is staring straight ahead, and you can see that there is blood on the front of a shirt, a Jackson Pollock of blood, and he is stricken, glazed with camera flashlight, stumbling away from the crime scene, and there behind the children and the police is the body of Dustin's mom, Colleen. You can see her corpse perfectly framed in the background, her limbs thrown out in a posture that is clearly one of death, violent death, and a broad stain of blood beneath her, and the imprint of her blood on Dustin's t-shirt where he had held her, his mom, for a moment when he found her body on the front stoop beneath the porch light. The other bodies, not in the photograph, are Dustin's father, Dave, who is in the living room with a gunshot wound to his chest, and his Aunt Vicky, who is dead beneath the kitchen table where she tried to hide from the gunman, and his Uncle Lucky by the sink, the corpse slumped against the bottom cabinets, his head thrown back, arms open as if falling backwards, shot in the mouth. These bodies weren't the kind that you could show in the newspaper, but the picture of the three children was just enough to convey a vivid sense of massacre. Chapter 6. By the time Dustin reached his office, the news of the discovery had already begun to circulate. Most people assumed, correctly as it would later turn out, that the body was that of Peter Allingham, a college sophomore and lacrosse player, who had gone missing in the wee hours of November 1st after an evening of bar hopping and Halloween parties, dressed in a cartoonish, racially insensitive Native American costume, feathers, buckskin, etc., seen by large numbers of people and then gone, very improbably vanishing, people said, on his way to the bathroom at the Daily Tavern, and he never came back to join his friends. Akil Ozarowski was sitting in the waiting room of Dustin's office, wearing earbud headphones and gazing at his smartphone, texting vigorously. His dark, shaggy hair hung down like blinders on either side of his eyes, and Dustin stood there in the doorway with his briefcase waiting to be noticed. He felt a bit nonplussed. They didn't have an appointment, but Akil had the habit of simply appearing. He was an odd case. He had ostensibly come to Dustin for smoking cessation hypnotherapy, but his susceptibility to hypnosis was very low. Instead, their sessions had devolved into loose, vaguely intimate discussions with no clear goal in mind. They'd talk about some conspiracy theory that Akil had read about on the internet, or they'd talk about Akil's insomnia or his resentful feelings, but after the first few appointments, they had all but ceased to mention smoking. "I just don't think I'm ready yet," Akil said. "But I do think you're helping me, Doctor. You're a good listener." Actually, Dustin wasn't sure that was true. In fact, he had learned very little about Akil in the months that they'd been meeting. Akil was about 30 years old, Dustin guessed, and based on his name, Dustin thought he might be biracial, but he wasn't sure. Akil had dark, deer-like brown eyes, and his long, straight hair was either black or dark auburn, depending on the light. His complexion could indicate any number of races. He gave no indication of his family background, even when Dustin asked direct questions. "Honestly," Akil said, "I'm not really interested in that stuff. These shrinks, they always want you to tell stories about your childhood and your past, like that's supposed to explain something. I don't really do that." The one thing that Dustin did know was that Akil had been a policeman and that he was now on medical leave from the Cleveland Police Department, though that situation, too, had never been clearly explained. Some kind of psychological difficulty, Dustin assumed. PTSD? Paranoia? There were no medical records that Dustin had been able to access, and even when he'd undertaken a surreptitious Google search, it had yielded few results. Akil was listed as a graduate of the Cleveland Police Academy, and there was a grainy photograph of him in his high school football team where he'd been a running back. He had a defunct LinkedIn page. Whatever he'd done to get himself on psychological leave from the police department, it hadn't made the news. Still, there was apparently something he needed. He glanced up at last and gave Dustin a grin. He politely pulled the cowrie shell of earbud from his ear, as if Dustin's waiting room were his own private space and he was surprised to be interrupted. "Hey," he said. "Hey," Dustin said. "I didn't realize we had a..." And Akil blinked a couple of times. "Did you hear the news about the dead kid?" Akil said. Dustin turned on the light and set his briefcase on a chair, and Akil stood up and stretched. Appointment?" Dustin said. "Do you want to hear my theory?" Akil said. "It's about Russell," Kate said. "Russell, my brother Russell?" he said, and she said, "Just listen," and then began to read to him from a news article. Now, nearly 29 years after his arrest, independent DNA tests by 3 different laboratories, she read. DNA tests on genetic evidence confirm what Tillman has long contended, that he is not the person who killed his mother, father, aunt, and uncle that June night in 1983. "What newspaper is this?" Dustin said. "This is unbelievable." Tillman will be the latest person to be exonerated by DNA, according to officials at the Innocence Project, a nonprofit legal clinic that investigates wrongful convictions. The test results show what Russell has said from the day he was arrested, that he is innocent, said Vanessa Zuckerbrot, an attorney for Innocence Project. I don't understand why we weren't contacted about this," Dustin said. "When was the last time anybody talked to him?" "All these years I knew I wasn't the one," said Tillman in an interview. "I believe there is a higher power greater than me that's been helping me all these years, keeping me together." Akil took out a map and unfolded it carefully on Dustin's desk. "Listen," he said, "this isn't just another weird rabbit hole I'm going down. This one is real. And you, Dr. Tillman, I think you're going to get this more than anybody else, I could tell. This is right up your alley." Dustin shifted uncertainly. Why do you say that? Up my alley? In what way?" "Just give me a minute," Akil said. "Let me, lay it out for you." He placed the map on the desk between himself and Dustin looked down at the little red stickers that had been pasted along the edges of the interstate corridors and the waterways in a kind of curving pattern, possibly a pattern. He thought of the way the light pollution, seen from outer space, revealed the outlines of the eastern seaboard and the Great Lakes. "Look," Akil said, "so each of these dots represents an apparent accidental death." "Apparent," he said, and he pointed to the northern corner of the state. "Look at here. Jonathan Frisbee, 21 years old, student at Ohio Northern, went missing 1-1-01, found 1-2-01, Maumee River, cause of death, drowning, blood alcohol level was 0.23. Vincent Isolato, 19, student at Ohio Northern University, reported missing 2-20-02, found 4-20-02, Maumee River, cause of death, drowning. Matt Potts, 21, student at Kettering University, missing 3-30-03, East Lansing, Michigan, found 4-02-03, Red Cedar River, cause of death, drowning. I can see where this is going," Dustin said, "but just wait. Just wait." Chapter 10. He was in his study when Kate called him. He saw her name come up on the caller ID, and he felt aware of his old feeling of attraction. Not even such a big taboo to be drawn to your cousin when you were a 13-year-old boy, but he had been embarrassed nevertheless, had never admitted it, though of course the girls knew, surely. They had been a certain kind of teenage girl, working class, Dustin thinks now, though of course back then they would have never used working class. Trailer trashy, maybe people would have said, or slutty. At the very least, it was clear that these girls were experienced, shrewd, practical, tube tops, short shorts, heavy makeup. And later, years later, there was this moment when he had been visiting Kate at her place in L.A. and she seemed so amused. This was when he was speaking at USC at a conference, and Kate had said, "So tell me about being a therapist. What's that like?" She had never been to college. She had worked as a hairdresser her whole life, had no interest in that kind of thing, and he was aware that her only concept of therapist were from TV or movies or whatever, the tweedy, dithering, absent-minded snob. And she was smiling at him, her eyes turned slyly sidelong, and she said, "What do you talk about with them?" Have any of them been, like, dangerously crazy? I just can't imagine. And now, here he was, a 41-year-old man in his study, how pretentious, at his desk, at his computer, checking his email and going over his notes, and he picked up the phone, and he wanted to be in the mode that was the person he would have been if... Chapter 11. Jesse Hamblin, Akil said, 21, student at Michigan State, missing 4404, never found. Clinton Combi, 19, student at Brownmeyer College, missing 5505, found 51605, Olentangy River, cause of death, drowning, blood alcohol, 0.34. Zachary Orozco, 18, freshman at Ohio University, missing 6606. That sends up some flags, right? Found 6806, Hocking River, cause of death, drowning, blood alcohol level, 0.34. Jeff Wamsley, 21, Ohio Northern University, missing 7707, found 72407, Maumee River. This is interesting. His father says to the reporters that, and I quote, rumors are circulating that there might be some kind of mad drowner in our midst. Now look at this one. Joshua McGibney, microbiology major from University of Dayton, went missing. You guessed it, doctor. I can see 8808 after leaving a rugby party. His body found 3 days later, face down in Wolf Creek. Blood alcohol level, 0.40. It's hard to imagine how he could get so drunk and walk away, right? But it's interesting. It makes you curious, doesn't it, doctor? Here, look at this one. Luke Gorringe, Delta College, student from Bay City, Michigan, reported missing 9/11/09. East Lansing, Michigan, found 10/15/09, Red Cedar River. How many are there? Dustin said. He looked at the folder that Akil was holding, a sheaf of paper, and Akil gave him a wry smile. How many? Including Peter Allingham, you mean? Chapter 12. This was the day that Kate called to tell him about Russell, about the DNA evidence, Russell to be released from prison a few days after Peter Allingham's body was recovered from the pond near the campus. There was no real connection to be made between the two events, except that later they adhered in Dustin's mind. So I'm a little confused about the timeline of all this, he said to Kate. The dates. At what point did this group, Innocence Project, right? At what point did they begin to work on Russell's case? And I don't understand why they didn't contact us. Why aren't they required by law to contact us since we're the victims' families and we're the ones who testify? Listen, Kate says, I'm as freaked out as you are, honey. Believe me. But it doesn't make any sense, Dustin said. Surely this whole thing has been underway for a long time, and the fact that we aren't hearing about it until he's practically out of the front of the gates of the prison. I know, Kate said. I'm in, like, shock. I don't even know what to think. It's like one blood test, and suddenly your whole life is... Russell and Dustin. Dusty and Rusty. That's what their parents called them sometimes, as if they were a matching set. Though, of course, they hadn't chosen Russell's name. Russell was a foster boy when he came to them, son of a drug addict mother, father unknown. He'd been living with a different foster family for several years, but then there had been a house fire, and he was orphaned again. Dustin's father had been deeply moved by this tragedy. Russell was 14 when they adopted him, and Dustin was 8, and Dustin can remember that day. There had been a party, and after the party had dispersed, he had seen Rusty standing in the backyard, staring out toward the horizon, western Nebraska, bordering on Colorado, the fields lined with telephone poles, the grasshopper oil wells gently nodding their sleepy heads. At the edge of the horizon, a low ridge of hills rose up from the flatlands. Dustin sat on the back steps and looked out along with Rusty. After a time, Rusty turned. His face was solemn, maybe brotherly. What are you staring at? Rusty said. And Dustin shrugged. Come over here, Rusty said. And when Dustin did, Rusty didn't say anything for a while. He considered Dustin's face. You want to know something? What? And Dustin breathed as Rusty's eyes held him. My actual mom died, he said. They say that she hung herself in prison, but I think they probably killed her. Who? Dustin said. Who killed her? But Rusty only shrugged. Then, abruptly, he gestured at the sky. He pointed. You see that? He said. That's the evening star. He put his palms firmly over Dustin's ears and tilted Dustin's head, swiveling it like it was a telescope. You see it? It's right there. And he drew a line with his finger from Dustin's nose to the sky. Dustin nodded. He closed his eyes. He could feel the cool, clay-like dampness of his brother's palms against his head. The sound of his brother's hands was like the inside of a shell.